Good evening and welcome to the Car, Sim and Race Driver Show with me, Hugh Hattrick. And on tonight's show, we have it's a very special show because yesterday the motoring world was found out that poor old Stirling Moss, who was at the good old age of 90, passed away yesterday. Now, I'm just going up. I don't know if Andrew, I also have a special guest coming online. I think, Andrew, you're there. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I can hear you perfectly. Yes.
That's excellent. Very good.
That's super. And I was just introducing the show to all our listeners on Podbean that we heard yesterday the very sad and tragic news that Stirling Moss had passed away at the age of 90 in his home in London. We hadn't heard from him for quite a while. He'd kind of been out of the limelight for the last 2 years. But for you, Andrew, what did he mean to you? Because obviously you're a big motorsport fan like myself. It was quite.
He was a hell of a character, wasn't he? He was incredible. I'm 50 years old ish, give or take, about 1,000 years either way, and I, you know, there's names that you can remember, but you don't know why. I don't know if you might have been 3 years old and someone said something and it stuck with you. Well, Stirling Moss was one of those names. Even before Barry Sheen and James Hunt, which was stuck in my, you know, I knew who they were. I knew what they did. I know the name Stirling Moss. Stirling Moss and Jackie Stewart were just names you knew from the early 70s. And I knew he was something to do with speed because people used to come out and say, who do you think you are? Stirling Moss. It was like, who do you think you are? David Bailey, you know, it was that kind of thing. apparently Stirling Moss was well known for speeding. So he was done quite a few times for going too fast in whatever he had with four wheels. So
yes, because I think he had a smart car. Did he not have a smart car or something? He used to race around London or some kind of thing. And I'm sure I saw him. I was in London once and right in the centre, the kind of nice kind of upmarket bit. And I'm sure I saw him. He was either on some kind of scooter or some kind of electric car or small car. And he was on his way, I think, to the post office. And I recognised you couldn't miss it with Stirling Moss because he was kind of racing around these little roads, you know. I'm sure it was quite near the palace. I'm sure it was near Buckingham Palace. We were on that bit. Near there, and I'm sure it was him. He was runner up four times, and he was third a further three times to the Formula One World Championship.
Yes, he was indeed. And for seven years. He was four times runner up, three times third, 1958, where he was driving for Van Wall, was the year that he came closest to winning the World Championship. And he lost the world championship for two reasons. One, by being he lost by a point. They got the world's first constructors' world championship, Van Wall, so a British team.
Yeah,
with the first constructors' world championship, and he lost the drivers' world championship by a point to Mike Hawthorn. In those days, like they do now, they had a point for the fastest lap, and. Uh-huh. He kept misinterpreting the pit board, saying that he needed to go faster to get the fastest lap. Mm. Okay. That's a little known story, but the big story was that Mike Hawthorn got disqualified from the Portuguese Grand Prix for reversing on the track. And Stirling Moss, that lost him 6 points. Stirling Moss went to the stewards and said he wasn't reversing on the track. He was on the grass. And got him reinstated. So his honesty and sportsmanship gave Mike Hawthorn 6 points back, which made him win the world championship by a single point. And Stirling Moss never regretted it. The people have asked him about it, why did you lose the world championship like that? And he kind of used to look at them like, what? doesn't compute. Yeah. What are you talking about, stupidest boy? I love that level of honor, that level of sort of sportsmanship. You just don't see, but he did it.
He was quite glamorous, wasn't he? I mean, to live in a big flat in London, similarly, everything in the flat was electronic.
He designed it.
Aye.
It was his own design. He had lifts. He had. You're right. He was. I don't know. It was. you imagine the glamour of Monaco, but in Kensington, Kensington High Street or something. It's just wow.
Because similarly, he came back and did lots of commercials in the '60s and the '70s and the '80s. To be fair, and he made, you know, that's, he made obviously good money out of that. And I think he did a lot more racing in the '80s, but I think he struggled. And that's what Martin Brundle was saying when he did come back, which is fair enough. Because I mean, that's a long, long time to come back and try and make an impact on the racing scene again, you know. But I remember because he did, like, I think there was like a Car and Driver magazine or something like that, and he was one of the journalists for that. And they were saying, you know, on the front cover, it was, you know, Stirling Moss testing a Ford Fiesta or something. So a really basic looking one, you know, which I'm sure he would have been really excited about.
What he got done for dangerous driving, for test driving a Mini? He's in a Mini and he's done for dangerous driving. I mean,
goodness me.
Okay. The Milli Millia. Let's talk about the Milli Millia. I mean, Stirling Moss, okay, people. The thing, I've said it and other people keep saying it, that he was the greatest racing driver never to win the World Championship. That really doesn't sum the man up. He was one of the greatest racing drivers ever because he could drive anything. I mean, his hero was Fangio, line two, you know. And he had, as a very young driver, the chance to drive in Fangio's team because all the teams thought he was too inexperienced to give it a go. So he did it. He managed to get hold of a second-hand Maserati 250F, did some races, did really well in them, and they went, well, we'll give you a punt, but you'll be a clear number two to Fangio. So he's driving behind Fangio, learning off of the Il Maestro. Uh-huh. But both he and Fangio both said that Stirling Moss was better in a sports car than Fangio was. And Fangio said he wasn't as good in a sports car. So you got the Milli Millia. Stirling Moss still holds the record for the Milli Millia. I mean, 1955?
Yeah, it's incredible, really.
992 miles in 10 hours. 99 miles per hour average speed.
Yeah.
And that includes two pit stops and three mountain passes. It's the equivalent, I think someone said, of driving from London to Aberdeen and back between 7 in the morning and getting back at tea time while having two petrol stops.
Goodness
he was
me.
Doing 170. Think about it.
Yeah,
that's in 1955. They had drum brakes, mate.
Goodness me.
And have you seen footage? I don't know if anyone's ever seen footage of, you remember like in the Group B rallying days where the road was filled with people and they would park in front of you and then close behind you? It was like that, but he's doing 170 miles an hour down straights on barely closed off roads in a Mercedes 300 SLR.
Yeah, yeah.
They invented the concept of pace notes. He had a journalist with him called Dennis Jenkinson.
That's right.
And they spent a couple of days going around the course, braking other cars to find out how fast they could go around corners and what was coming up. And Jenkinson had this sort of roll. He invented this rolling system, a bit like an old-fashioned Roman, you know, where you roll on one and roll off the other, so that he could keep track of where he was going, and hand signals as if to go straight flat over this crest or there's going to be a corner and stuff like this.
Yeah.
So 170 miles an hour in 1955.
Yeah.
It is and he used to wiggle. He'd wiggle the car. Two things he did, and I've heard this. He said this. That TV show that I sent you links to on YouTube today, which I used to own and was brilliant, Power and the Glory.
Yes, I remember that. I do remember that. Brilliant. I even remember the music.
Oh, the music was amazing because it was really evocative, wasn't it?
It was. It got you into it. Yeah.
Doon, doon, and it kind of builds and builds. And you want to go racing.
I was proud of me when we know the music from 40 years
ago. I know, it's great. I mean, I'll go on about it, but now I've found it. I've got it to send it to you. You know what I'm talking about. There's two, episode two and three. One of them sport the road racers, saloon racing, which has a lot of Stirling Moss in it because he talked about the Milli Millia. And then there's the episode three is called The Right Stuff, and it's what makes a great racing driver what you need to be.
Yeah.
And he talks about his crashing that and all sorts of stuff. And anyway, in part of the conversations in over the whole of the 12 episodes of the series, he talks about things like the psychology of winning. So, okay, he was a great sportsman, but say it got a bit wet on a particular course, what he would do is he would deliberately look like he's losing the car a bit. And they had other drivers attesting to this when they're interviewing them, going, "Oh my goodness, if Moss is having trouble, it must be bad." And they'd slow down, he'd disappear off, so he'd make it look like he was, I don't know, he was struggling when he wasn't. And the other thing he did is when he got these, he was playing the other drivers and playing on his reputation as being superb in the wet and a superb driver. This is what I'm saying. He wasn't just the guy that didn't quite win, because it never mattered to him to win. Because if it did, he would have driven for Ferrari, or he would have driven for Maserati, or he would have never drove for the best teams. He drove deliberately for British teams. That's why he drove for Van Wall. He tried the BRM, but it was so terrible, he spat him out and he said, "I'm not touching that car again." It took him 10 years to win a single Grand Prix. You know, and he raced everything. What is it? I was listening to earlier today, and they were saying that Schumacher in 24 years drove about 10 different cars, right? Uh-huh. Stirling Moss in 14 years drove over 100 cars in sports cars, rally driving, Formula One, every conceivable kind of four-wheeled thing he drove, and he won.
Ultra competitive, and obviously I remember seeing that when he went around the corner in a racing car, you had to almost kind of caress it round, you had to kind of lure it into a bend. And they were saying this on the Sky Sports one, that, you know, that he was able to control the car and never take it over the edge of the tyres, so he never ran out of tyres in terms of overheating them, and he was always keeping it right, you know, very, very smooth, and obviously and had that incredible skill. And I think at that point, it didn't really, as you say, it didn't really matter if he won or lost, but he was always up in the top echelons because he was very, very good. And in that time, it was incredibly dangerous. I mean, those cars were absolutely lethal if it went wrong.
Six people a year died?
Yeah, yeah. But
in late 60s, I've read Jackie Stewart's autobiography, and there's a picture in the middle of 12 racing drivers, including Sir Jackie. And the caption was, "By the end of the year, half of these are dead, including Jim Clark." And you're like, what? And they were closer in those days. You know this nonsense where they move a lot and bash into each other today? None of that ever happened. So somebody asked Jackie Stewart about that. He goes, "You know, when you went over the edge and stuff, because Schumacher, do you remember he used to, in practice, he used to go faster and faster and faster until he came off, and then he knew where the limits were." They asked Jackie Stewart, "So, you know, what about when you used to do that? Did you have, you know, you went over the limit?" He goes, "No." "What?" "No. Well, because if you did, you died because you hit a tree." You went to, like Jim Clark, 15 foot up bits of a corpse in a tree. You didn't go over the edge. You didn't bash into each other because it killed someone. And because of that, they all used to holiday together. They used to get on the planes together. They used to, wherever they did, they drove to the circuit. Together.
But they shared a flat. They shared a flat together, didn't they?
A lot of the time.
I'm sure actually Stewart shared a flat with. I'm trying to think who it was that he shared a flat.
It was Jim Clark. And Jim Clark. Graham Hill.
Yeah.
Graham Hill.
Well, I remember there was this last week. It was the anniversary of when Jim Clark died and when he was buried in Churnside. The thing was. They had a picture of all the drivers at the side of in the graveyard, and how many of them? There was like Jochen Rindt, there was Graham Hill, there were, and I looked at them all and I thought, my goodness, how many of them would be dead in the matter of years after that time? I think it was Graham Hill 1968 or something, or 69 or 70. Or
so Hill? Of me. No, he was in the 70s, Hill. But he died in a plane crash.
Yeah, I mean, I know obviously he wasn't killed.
He survived the dangerous stuff, and he died in a simple plane crash in the fog. Because it was like Colin McRae, you know, he's like, what?
I'll never forget that. That's when they said there'd been a helicopter accident, and they suspected it could have been McRae, but they weren't sure. And then eventually it was confirmed, and that was a shock.
And of course, same with Richard Burton as well. It's just,
His son. It was his son, wasn't it, that was killed in it. But no, it's when those things happen, it's an absolute tragedy. And it's quite a thing. I mean, the thing is, eventually, so many drivers now, we have such a number of that are very old. You kind of think, well, eventually it's going to happen. You are going to lose one or two. But, you know, we've had John Surtees, now Stirling Moss, we've had Andrew Cowan, we've had a few others. And I mean, because they were getting, you know, pretty well on in age. But it's the end of an era, isn't it? It does signify the end of an era when these things happen. And you kind of think, who do the younger ones now really look up to, you know, in motor racing? And, you know, thankfully people like Mansell are still about and are kind of still having an influence, but who else, you know?
Do you not find it hard to think of the likes of Damon Hill and Mansell as the older generation of drivers now? They're little whippersnappers that just started, really, but they're not. I mean, they're not at all.
Yeah, it's quite funny because
they had Tony Brooks on the radio talking about Stirling. And he's still alive, but, you know, he was of that era as well, 50s, early 60s. Who else is there left?
I mean, I remember from, I mean, I don't know in terms of how Ant is, I know that you're listening there with us there, Ant, in terms of as a Grand Prix fan, when the eras change, you know, like when Schumacher came in 1991, I think it was, and then when he left in 2005, I thought he could have gone on for a bit more. You know, I was quite disappointed when he left Ferrari because I was a big Ferrari fan. And, you know, what he had brought to Ferrari was huge. I mean, those final four world championships, I remember waiting for so long to get a Ferrari driver who could actually win races, you know, and take the title. I'd been a huge John Lacey fan, and I longed for Lacey to win in his Ferrari, you know, from 93, 94, and also in 95 when he had that.
And Berger was a great character as well. Berger was great as well.
The 95
but the problem
Ferrari
wasn't the drivers. Yeah. I mean, as good or bad, I mean, I don't consider Lacey to be top flight, okay?
I mean, he won the Formula 2. Won the Jeep, was it Formula 2, I think, the championship, and was seen to be good, but I don't think he had the consistency.
Neither of us, well, maybe you could. I know that neither of us could step into a Formula 1 car of any era and just drive it off.
Yeah, yeah.
Never mind drive it competitively. Okay? Yeah. So when I say not top flight, I don't mean he's not a good driver because he's better than I've displayed, you know, and he was still one of the top 20 drivers in the world. So,
And to get the Formula 1, and
he was driving for Formula 1 for a long time. He wasn't there for a week and gone.
Yeah, he was about 12 years,
you know. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that for them to have won a race, they needed to have a car under them, which is why I get very frustrated with people saying, it's all about technology. Well, it's not. But a big part of it is.
Yeah.
The thing that always intrigued me about Schumacher is that he had a profession. He may not have been the outright fastest person on the track, actually. He was incredibly fast. But there was times, and I've heard DC talking about this, where Hakkinen was faster, for example. In flat-out pace, Hakkinen was probably a faster driver. But what Hakkinen didn't do, and Schumacher did, was cement a team around him.
Yeah, yeah.
Schumacher got, whether it was him or something about him, he got the right people around him. John Todd, Rory Byrne, Ross Brawn. And he helped Ross Brawn and John Todd cement the Ferrari team, which was split. Even worse than it is now. Mm. It was, and for a start, it was split into two factories. But they're both on the same site. But one was the chassis factory and the other was the engine factory. It's Enzo Ferrari's old bugbear thing about you don't need a good chassis, you just need a good engine. So you have the engine people going, well, you're a waste of space anyway, because as long as we build the best engine, you know. And then there was an intra-team rivalry that ruined the team's chances. Yeah. And again, reading Ross Brawn's book with Adam Parr, Total Competition, he talks about how he got the team gelled because he was technically not in charge of the whole team. He was the technical director of the chassis. And there was another man, an Italian, who was in charge of the engine. What he started doing was he started to go for dinner with him. Mm-hmm. He just literally took him to dinner every week until they became mates. And once they were mates, they could work together. And when they could work together, it wasn't two teams under the name Ferrari. It was the Ferrari team, Scuderia Ferrari. And that's when Schumacher, because it took a couple of years, didn't it, for the car to be so competitive that they were moaning about the car, like they're moaning about the Mercedes. I mean, we've all heard this before. Oh, it's too dominant. Well, it was too dominant a few years ago when it was a Ferrari.
Yeah,
it's always been somebody too dominant.
Formula One is always going to, it does tend to get like that when teams get a way ahead and work that bit better. And that's kind of the thing, isn't it? But it's funny how the era's changed. I mean, you had the, you know, like Schumacher coming in, and then when he retired, then it was Alonso when he was very young, coming in on 2001, 2002, Mark Webber and people like that. And it always changes. And then, of course, eventually we got Lewis Hamilton in 2007. And people were quite excited about him because he'd done incredibly well in winning the GP2 championship in amazing style. I mean, some of his races were incredible. I remember watching one from Turkey when he had spun out on the first lap. And he got right the way back to second place from last on the grid, basically. And his overtaking. And it was quite an incredible race to watch. So he was seen as something special. And when he came in 2007, he was. Straight from the word go, from fourth to second at the first corner, you know, and overtook Alonso, his teammate in the McLaren, you know. I think he had to get the place back eventually.
That year's battle was frustrating and yet one of the most entertaining years, Formula One, simply because those two kept saying, it's a bit like Rosberg and Hamilton in that year.
Yeah.
They were butting head to head. Equal machinery, who's the best? And they were both brilliant, and that was the thing. And they both hated losing and wouldn't do as they were told. Fantastic.
Remember, was it Hungary that Alonso blocked Hamilton and stopped him and came in the pits, or he blocked him in the pits and he couldn't get out?
I know exactly the race you mean, but I couldn't tell you which race it was. But yes, exactly. He's like, I'm parking here, mate.
And then he got a fine, and then they all got a fine, and they're all getting all sorts of...
And they both lost. I mean, the people about Kimi Raikkonen, if Stirling Moss was the greatest who never got a championship, Kimi Raikkonen is the worst that ever did. He looked into that, didn't he? He just plodded along, no one noticed. Did he win a race that year? I don't think he did. Did he? Did he win any races at all?
Won in Australia, and I think he won in China. Did he not win in China in 2008?
I just remember it like, who? Raikkonen? No. I mean, he's spectacular and he flashes a brilliance, but he's now world champion. What happened was that Alonso and Hamilton got in each other's way for the entire year, and then Hamilton dropped it because he was immature. Yeah, very simple. Yeah. But it made for a great. But I get very frustrated when people keep talking, "Oh, it's boring because this team's dominant." And they go, "Oh, Mercedes must be cheating." That's funny, you know, because in a long time FIA stood for something Ferrari something something, not Mercedes something something. The F2004 was the most boring car ever because it just kept winning with Schumacher at the wheel. Red Bull with Vettel, four consecutive world titles. How boring was that? But actually, the racing was pretty good. It was a fight until the end. Where again, teammate Webber. Webber ruined, you know, and him bashing into each other. It's entertainment USA, that was. Boom.
Aye,
as they say in North Wales, boom, great. But yeah,
it's amazing how things happen, and I think you have those battles. I mean, I think we were talking earlier, obviously, about Stirling Moss, and of course, you know, there was that honour. They wouldn't have bashed each other off as it was so dangerous. There would have been real trouble. And I think nowadays they kind of know that they can maybe get away with it in some cases. That's dodgers, why they're able to do it. Yeah, and it can. I mean, it's rare that it gets to that. I mean, we had that with the Red Bulls and things. I always remember in Turkey, that was an incredible race, you know, when as you say, when Vettel and Webber came together. And then also when Daniel Ricciardo and Verstappen came together in Azerbaijan, that was a huge one. So it kind of shows you the difference. Mind you, the cars are obviously an awful lot stronger. I mean, I remember there was always suspension bits going and all sorts of stuff.
The problem is you get the likes of Verstappen. Danny Ricciardo, he close racer, and he makes the odd mistake, don't get me wrong. Yeah. Superb overtaker. He goes for gaps. He does stuff that people don't think is going to happen. Hamilton was the same, and he was criticised all the time when he first came in, if you remember. They was always saying, oh, he was dangerous because he went for stuff and went for overtakes. But both of them are very, very careful about where they put themselves and what danger they put other people in. They're firm but fair. Does that make any... If that's the way you're putting it. Whereas Max... he justifies dangerous moves with, well, it's dangerous sport. He has no idea what dangerous... If his best mate got killed, that's the difference. It's the consequences. They don't think there's going to be one. This is why it was such a shock when that young lad died last year. Because they're going, for years, the person who died was Senna. And they forget about Roland Ratzenberger even. They just think, oh, Senna died, but that's the only one. And the cars are so safe now, it can't happen again. Yeah, T-bone someone under an 80 mile an hour, they're going to die.
And the other chap who was involved in that crash, he's now walking again, but only with crutches. And he's had to rebuild. And his legs were incredibly badly broken. But I think he is walking about now. I think he is possibly on crutches. Okay. But he is actually rebuilding. It's quite a thing. So tonight's show is a little bit shorter than normal because I think the last time we've been doing about 2 hours, an hour and a half, and I think it's probably good to keep it to around about the half an hour, 40-minute mark. But in this point, what do you think will happen next? I mean, this has been obviously a kind of crazy year. We've obviously got the coronavirus that's kind of brought everything to a halt, and no Formula One races. Obviously, we've got esports races, which are coming up, and there's a few more coming, and hopefully we'll have some exciting news about that very soon. But it has really put everything into a different spotlight. And, you know, we've had, you know, a lot of famous people kind of leaving us and passing on. Now we've had, obviously, Stirling Moss. It's going to be interesting when the racing finally gets going as to how the paddock and the Formula One kind of circus, as it is, as they call it, copes with that, and actually, you know, how it responds to all of this, because at the moment people are only doing it in their living room like we are tonight.
Yeah.
But when it actually comes into the studio, people see it. I wonder how they'll respond to all of this. There's a lot to take in.
It's an excellent question because the virtual Grand Prix. It's an excellent chance for the virtual Grand Prix to gain a bit of footing and a bit of exposure and the fan base, which, frankly, other than the hard line gamers that obviously watch it already. That's great. I'm disappointed that they haven't made more of it, in fact, because they could have.
Yeah.
They're showing all these old races, which is great. It's nice enough. I haven't watched any of them because I saw them all before. But yeah. I might watch some virtual Grand Prix if they were on and there were some names I knew and I could support them.
They're
not really.
I think they've been caught napping, to be fair. I think, you know, in terms of, I know that a lot of, they always say like the games are getting better, and they are, but they're designed for in-home, you know, PlayStation use or PC use. They're not designed to be viewed in such a way that we see it on TV. And I think that's a problem because, yes, you can watch them on lobbies, and I think that's how they make it work. They have a lobby, and then the camera, the way that they built the game is built, we can access that, and they can stream it out so we can see what they're seeing, and we can see all the cars together, but it doesn't have all the information that we're used to. For example,
it's very obvious that they've got a likely tool which isn't perfect, but they're just going to use it. They're not going to spend any money on it. They're just going to use it because, you know, like everyone, they're worried about losing everything. I've read a number of reports of people saying, we're going to lose three or four teams, never mind. Some three or four of the smaller teams are just going to disappear. Possible. Ross Brawn has already said that he thinks that the season's going to start behind closed doors. But, you can't do that. We might not have a choice.
Yeah, I don't mind.
It's mainly a televised sport.
I want to see a race. I'm paying for this, and I'm not getting any value.
The money's going to come from TV. It's not going to come from even 300,000 people turning up for the track. The tracks need that money.
To keep going.
Let's be straight. The tracks, that's where the tracks get their money. People through the doors. But the actual sport needs TV.
So
it is better that something happens so that the teams can get paid, they can do the job they're meant to be doing, and we can all watch it on TV than nothing, isn't it? Surely. That's got to be done.
What's interesting
but
is
when we don't know when we have no idea. No one knows what's happening anywhere in the world. Never mind Formula One.
I mean, I think they have to be so careful because they can't put people at risk or in danger. And at the moment, what was an interesting on my other podcast that I do, the Hattricks Orlando Holiday Guide podcast, I read a report that Disney and Universal were potentially looking at reopening their theme parks on the 1st of June. Now, I think personally that's quite optimistic because I thought I think it's unlikely that things will be calmed down enough by then. How do you limit people to get in? You'd have to have about 100 people in the whole site. It's not going
to
be.
You've got to have enough people going there for it to pay the thousands of people that are employed to do that job. We've both been there. We know the number of staff it takes to do that.
Of course, that is so many. It's huge. It's like a town or a city in a
bit. It's like a city. It's Orlando's the bit in the middle, and then all around it's the theme parks, isn't it? I went on the Jaws ride. Have you been on the Jaws ride? You must have been on the Jaws ride. So impressed with the lass that was the one pretending to steer the boat, pretending to shoot the shark. I mean, you know as a fact that that lass tried to make it in Hollywood, and this was something she was doing to practice acting and get paid for it, you know? It's like waiting tables, but she gets to do a bit of acting while she's doing it. There was it 10 boats on the loop? That's 10 of them. And then you've got all the people, the maintenance people, and then you've got all the people in all the kiosks. There must be 5,000 people at minimum working in just...
So they all get $100
Disney resorts there.
Fairly adds up, $500,000 a day plus, isn't it, and more.
They've got to pay them. They've got to pay for the power. They've got to pay for maintenance. They've got to pay for the food. You can't do that with a limited number of people going to the... They've got to have capacity.
That's why 50,000 people turn up or more, isn't it? I mean, it's thousands of people a day turn up to go in normally. Yeah. But saying that, I mean, I think they're being ambitious for that. But I suppose if it was a closed door race and things were potentially maybe in a city that were or a country that wasn't affected, and all of the mechanics and all the rest of it were all tested to make sure that they were fine, then perhaps
that's what they're going to
do. At the end of June, I think maybe possible. I just can't see it before July.
July.
I think that's going to be the earliest.
British Grand Prix, July.
Yeah, that would be great.
British Grand Prix, Silverstone. And if they've got any sense, as we've said, they'll do a compressed weekend because they've got to get the championship races in, as many as they can. They'll do a compressed weekend with multiple races. They'll take the chance to try new formats. It's what they need to do. Yeah. If they've got no one coming and they've got this incredible, unusual situation to work around, they've got a chance to mix things up a bit just to see what happens with relatively small consequences, because we'll all be going, well, at least we're watching something. July.
Do you think Formula One will go driverless and it will have a kind of esports setup?
No.
I think there might be other formulas that try that. I mean, you've got like remote control cars. I've always said that for a long time. But I think people need drivers in Formula One, and they need to have an impact. They need to be meaningful and doing something.
Would you be dreaming about being a Formula One remote controlled car driving world champion? Because I am not. I don't dream about sitting on that game in the arcades, which sticks in your crotch and you keep nearly falling off, doing a pretend 200 mile an hour in front of a screen on a pretend motorbike. I don't. I miss sitting in a car. I miss taking S-Bends through Scotland. It's a visceral thing.
When
you're shaken, but look, Formula One, when it was working and we had the 1.6 V6s that you hate, there's a reason why you hated them.
Because there's no sound.
Because the sound didn't shake your bones.
But it doesn't, yeah. But
when it liquefy your kidneys, did it?
Yeah.
You could still hear afterwards.
Yeah. You could hear them all go past. And I think, to be fair, one of my mates, Jonathan, he went to the Silverstone Grand Prix a few years ago, and he said when they all went past on their, the first lap, and they were all right after each other, then that was pretty loud. And I think they are a bit louder. They have done some work to make them a bit better. But it's because the rev range is so low. You know, it's 12,000 revs, which I know that sounds like a lot in a normal car, but we're used to 19,000. And when you have that,
I liked the 19,000. I used to, that one race I went to, the Hockenheim Grand Prix, I remember we were walking back on the side that Jim Clark curves, that side, and you, one part where you walked really close to the track.
Yeah,
it was on that first massive straight, and you,
Were went out into,
30 feet away from the side of the track,
on
the inside of the big barrier and all this kind of stuff, but you were still there. And the F3000 race was on, and they were V8s, weren't they? Was it 3 litre V8s or something like that?
Oh, yeah. Formula 3000,
F3000, and they went past, and I was on the phone to my wife at the time, and I could have been smacked over the head with something and I wouldn't have noticed because I was being shut like a leaf by these. And they didn't, they sounded like an engine, rather than screech. I don't like screech. I don't see the point of screech. It hurts.
It's kind of
it's too much for me.
Yeah,
it's like I think all
The Ferrari V12 engines in the Formula Ones, they were much higher revs. That's what gave them that tune, because they were quite distinct. But they weren't as raw as the Renault. The V10 Renaults were quite a strong, hard sound to hear. But the V12 Ferraris were much easier on the ear, and also had a much nicer kind of tone to them. They were definitely a higher revs, but it was a lovely sound.
I liked the Mercedes V10. It had a really unusual. It went whoop whoop. It kind of had this howl. Yeah. It had a howl.
Like
some banshee.
But I was watching
Southeast London. I don't know where the factory is. Near Guildford, something like that.
There was a great video. It's in Guildford, I think.
Guildford Engineering. Elmore Engineering, which is now Mercedes, AMG vehicle special, something German, something, I don't know.
But when I was watching a video called that Bose, I think it was Bose 92 did, I think it was, and he goes all over Italy and all over the country doing these amazing races. But, you have robots racing camel.
Yes. Yes, it's true, you do. And I watch that even less. Oh, Ant.
All comments are good comments.
I would watch a robot camel racing. That'd be amazing. That'd be like a Disney cartoon. Yeah. Wally with a camel.
Going back to my previous statement.
Before we got onto camels.
It was the one when they had, it wasn't the overdrive. What was the thing? Oh, it was that thing that backfired through the exhaust. It was trickery in the exhaust system. It was done like 2011, 2012. What was that? The V-Arch or something, in the back of the cars that they had in the V8s.
Oh, the F-duct.
Yes, the F-duct. And the thing was, the sound was phenomenal because there's a great video of all the cars at Monza. And they're coming through the first and second Lesmos. So they come out of the chicane and they're really accelerating really, really hard. And then they just back off just enough to get enough grip, to get around the first Lesmos.
Oh, no, not the F-duct. It was blown exhaust. You mean the blown exhaust. Yes.
Double diffuser or something. And it goes, but it was like a tune in itself. And it sounded like...
You liked that, really?
You need to watch. I'll need to get the link for the video. Yeah, and I'll send it to you.
I've heard that. I hated it. People like me hated it because it sounded like a massive fart. It was like this huge, massive fart.
But it was. It was a continual note. It was a proper note.
Because what they were doing, they needed to somehow keep the gases coming out the exhaust to blow through the Venturi and all that kind of stuff to give a kind of a fake flow and suck it onto the ground. The Red Bull was the master of that one. That's why they had those. They were so quick. That was like their thing that they were really good at. Blown exhaust. But to do that, like you say, that it's like the end. Something had to keep going, even though they were slowing down.
Oh, it was Denson insane. I remember Denson Button talking about that, and how it was almost like you're going flat out. You had to keep your foot flat to keep the grip, and then all of a sudden you got this incredible grip going through. That's why his 2009 Grand Prix car on F1 2019 is one of the fastest cars to do the classic. because it's got so much grip. You've got some of the top tens, I think, in using that car.
See, that's, if you think about it, that's just like the Brabham, Gordon Murray's Brabham fan car.
Fan car, yeah.
Do you remember the fan car? It had this big fan on the back of the engine. And that was in the days when Brabham was owned by Bernie Ecclestone, who was as dodgy in those days as he ever was. And so they invented this car, this massive fan, which drew, let's put it the way Bernie Ecclestone would have put it at the time. It drew cool air in from underneath the car and went over the engine to cool the engine. It's for cooling the engine, Governor. Honest, Governor. Mind you, quote, it does squat 6 inches on the suspension when you rev it. It won the first race it entered and was banned immediately. So they've always done this. Oh, something clever. Ban it. Oh, you can't have that. That's an advantage. Ban it.
It is funny. It is funny. Well, we started off talking about Stirling Moss. But I think, we've covered it quite well, to be fair, because, we've talked about the different kind of eras of Formula One, and it is the end of an era now that Stirling has passed. But he has, he has huge respect with all of the drivers, young and old. And I think it's going to be interesting. This is a very tough year for the Formula One brigade. And you kind of think, once we finally get back to racing, it's going to take a while to settle down. And we're all looking forward to it. In fact, I can't wait to get back to it. But we'll have to see how it all goes. But what would be your final thoughts, Andrew, as to your for this kind of the news that Stirling has passed?
It was a shock. I mean, this wasn't, apparently he contracted a chest infection in about Christmas 2016 in Singapore. So this is not a recent thing. He's been battling for a while. And he 4 years. Three years fighting this illness at the age, and he's 90, and he just went, I'm off. My thought is this, that gentleman did more than 550 competitive races. He won 46% of those. And we've done this before in my geekiness. There's only one other driver I know that's got that percentage win rate, and that was Juan Manuel Fangio,
his
hero.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's lovely that you were telling me how good he was with his tyres and this kind of stuff, because that's the kind of stuff he would have learnt off of Fangio as well, following him.
Yeah.
Because Fangio was the master at not driving any faster than you needed to.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think, as you say, it's the end of an era.
Yeah,
We were denied his massive crash, which you've seen pictures of and there's footage of.
Yes, I saw that yesterday. That was horrendous.
Goodwood, it's in the last 18. Not long before that, he'd won Monaco in. It was very underpowered. It was the previous year's car.
Yeah.
It was very underpowered compared with the short-nosed Ferraris that he was racing against. And he didn't win from the front. He got the pole position in it.
Yeah.
And then he came off the grid in third or something like that, and he overtook lap 14. He overtook the first and second cars and won the race, being pushed to the end. A superb race. So that's the kind of thing. His teammate was Graham Hill. Jim Clark was in that race. Can you imagine the battles that would have gone on between Jim Clark and Stirling Moss? It would have been kind of like old guard, new guy coming in thing. Yeah. It would have been, and we were denied all that, which is really sad. But at least we had his knowledge, we had his wisdom, we had the fact that he liked going around talking about Totti all the time. He really did. I've heard him. girls, gorgeous, totty, wah. You know, he was a proper. He was a dirty. He was a dirty young man, and he was a dirty old man. He was funny. He was like, you know, when you some people, you know, Niki Lauda was one of them that you're always going to get a good quote from, and he was one of them. But intelligent. I mean, you could listen to him talk about stuff, and you would learn something. And he's gone.
Yeah.
And it's not fair.
Yeah,
but at least he got the chance to live.
Yeah, full to good old age of 90. Yeah. Now that's
when
the thing.
So many died so young because he could have ended it. He was in a coma for a month after that accident.
Yeah.
He couldn't drive a car for over a year.
Yeah. So, no, it was quite a remarkable recovery, really. That was the thing. Well, just before we go, if you'd like to visit our website, which is www.hughhattrick.com. You can see all our motorsport videos there. There is the links to subscribe to the channel as well, which is fantastic. And then you'll never miss a show and a special edition. But thank you very much to all our listeners, to Ant and the others as well that are there with us tonight, and to all who'll be listening to this on the podcast when it comes out in a few hours' time. But you've been listening to the Car Sim and Race Driver Show with me, Hugh Hattrick, and my very special guest, Andrew Marr. Find us out and drive fast and don't crash. Find us out.
Don't sneeze.
That's true.